Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're going on a road trip to meet people who are working in Appalachia to preserve a part of American culture and traditions. We'll meet a man in West Virginia who returned to his home to help his uncle run their family's historic grist mill.
They say absence makes the heart grow fonder. I just always wanted to come back.
We'll hear from a young woman whose family has been singing traditional Appalachian and British ballads for eight generations.
It's got a lot of unrequited love and murder and all that sort of stuff.
All the things that make up a classic
ballad.
All
the things that make up a good soap opera.
And an artist discovers inspiration when he rediscovers his grandfather's traditional pottery.
Never really found a focus until I started looking closely at my own history and, you know, all the things that you grow up seeing that you just take for granted.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia farmers markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're traveling to some really special places that aren't on most maps or tourist brochures and learning about new ways to explore the places we already know. We're celebrating Appalachians who have been making things in the mountains for generations and those who are preserving those traditions and keeping them alive for others to enjoy. On this show, we'll take you to some of those places and find out why it really is important to get outside. It's part of our ongoing series called Hidden Gems, where we will explore some of Appalachia's best and sometimes unknowingly kept secrets. We begin in Monroe County, not too far from where I live in the southeastern corner of West Virginia, at the tail end of the Allegheny Mountains, one of the ranges here within the Appalachians. A few years ago, we brought you a story about bloody butcher corn. It's a type of cornmeal that's ground at one of the last remaining grist mills in Appalachia. 100 years ago, grist mills weren't just a place where people went to buy cornmeal and flour. They were also community gathering places. But supermarkets replaced the local grist mill economy, and few working mills are still in operation today. The West Virginia Preservation Alliance placed Reed's Mill on the list of its endangered properties last year. Roxy Todd revisited Monroe County, where the millman, Larry Mustaine, is wondering how long he could continue to keep his family's business going.
The drive to Reed's Mill through the misty back roads is long and winding. The county where it's located, Monroe County, doesn't even have a single stoplight. Like so many people who grew up in West Virginia, the man who owns Reed's Mill, Larry Mustaine, says he had to leave the state to see the region's real value.
My mother and dad separated, and we moved away from here. They say absence makes the heart grow fonder. I just always wanted to come back.
He and his uncle, Aubrey Reed, farmed together when he came back to West Virginia in 1975. He spent a lot of his childhood here, helping his uncle inside the mill. When his uncle passed away, Mustaine decided to follow in his footsteps.
So much of what he taught me and what I knew, it's just in me. I don't even know it's there.
The creek that runs behind the mill, and which used to power the stone grinder, begins here at the top of Peters Mountain.
This creek is unbelievable. It rises out of springs off of Peters Mountain.
This small but mighty creek once powered dozens of mills. Today, only this one remains. Mustaine sells a special heirloom corn called Bloody Butcher.
Bloody Butcher is actually white corn. In other words, if you crack the grain open, it's white inside. Even these red ears are white inside.
This corn has been passed down for generations, just like this mill.
There's a formula that you have to follow to select seed corn from the Bloody Butcher. It's an open pollinated corn. You just plant it over and over. You don't have to get new seed every year like hybrid corn. And he had a formula of what he would pick out, so many red, so many orange, so many white, so many speckled ears. And I should have wrote all that down, but I just, even though I was in my 40s and 50s after I came back here, I guess I just always thought he was going to be here.
Today, Reed's Mill attracts visitors from all over the state and beyond.
My name is Elmer Napier. I've been here, I don't know how many times I've been here. Met Larry, who's a very interesting person. And I keep coming back. I'll just come attached to it, I guess.
Napier lives in Florida half of the year and in West Virginia during the summer. He says he's visited 40 mills across West Virginia. Reed's Mill was built in the late 1700s, but is in good shape compared with others in the state.
I've been in four mills. I think they're still grinding in the state. But, you know, they don't do very much grinding at all anymore in the mills. I think the ones that are here will be here. I think so. Because, you know, it's part of history and we've lost enough of them.
I think it would be a real tourist draw to the area if we could have a few of these mills that are left standing to be fully operational.
Steve Dransfield lives a few miles from this mill. Like Mustang, his family has been farming in this valley for generations. He says Reed's Mill is part of his history, too, and he'd like to help Mustang continue to keep the mill going.
It was always my dream to see all the belts and pulleys going and the water flowing through and the turbines turning and the grindstones grinding. But, you know, what he's able to do, you can come here today and you can see at least a small portion of what the whole operation was.
I sometimes tell people to this day, I don't know that I know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to do what he always did and keep it going.
Mustang is in his 80s, and he keeps this mill going the best he can. But he's getting older, and he says he's not sure who will be here to help take over the mill after him. He hopes that someone in his family, maybe one of his sons, will decide to take it on. But he's not ready to quit yet. Today, he grinds cornmeal and flour with an electric stone grinder. But his dream is to see the millstones up and running again, so the mill will grind cornmeal the old-fashioned way.
The Leffel Water Wheel Company tell me that turbine, that it probably was made in the 1880s or 90s, it's a 10 horsepower, and a new one through them now would cost about $30,000 or $40,000.
And he might be getting some assistance from the West Virginia Preservation Alliance. In 2017, the group listed Reed's Mill as one of the top endangered properties in West Virginia. This designation is meant to highlight the risk of losing the property and to attract attention from the public and encourage others to help restore the building. The group offers a 20% loan guarantee on renovation projects, which basically means they would assume part of the debt if a borrower defaults on a loan. If Mustang switched the mill to a nonprofit business, he would be eligible for more assistance to help maintain and renovate the building. For now, Mustang says he's happy just to continue grinding. He sells heirloom cornmeal, whole wheat flour, and another West Virginia specialty, buckwheat flour.
I'm clear out of buckwheat flour. And I've had people was here the other day going to St. Augustine, Florida, wanted buckwheat. I just can't keep up.
Although drop-in customers can sometimes find the mill open as they pass through Monroe County, Mustang recommends people call ahead to make sure he can give visitors a tour. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Monroe County, West Virginia.
You can catch the video companion to that story at our first public live recording session. Come join us on Saturday, October 20th in Beckley, West Virginia at the Raleigh Playhouse and Theater. Watch our website, wvpublic.org, for more details. While making cornmeal is a tradition that's been passed down for hundreds of years, our next story is about a more modern art form, neon sign making. In recent years, neon signs have emerged as a decorating trend in homes and apartments, but we usually associate them with cities and bars as a signal of bustling nighttime activity. Peggy Lee declares, "I'm going out where the neon signs shine down on the avenue." Simon and Garfunkel's "Eyes Were Stabbed by the Flash of a Neon Light." And the Kinks sing, "The traffic jams and neon lights of the great metropolis." And there's that Petula Clark song.
Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty high.
The signs that light up many businesses in West Virginia's Greater Kanawha Valley were made far from the places those songs depict, in a workshop on a quiet side street in the small town of St. Albans. Emily Hilliard visited the owner of Day Sign Company and brings us this story.
James L. Day has been making neon signs by hand for 5 decades, providing custom offerings to businesses across the Greater Kanawha Valley. James started this workshop in 1964 when he and his wife, a St. Albans native, moved from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Name's James Day, James L. Day, and I operate Day Sign Company in St. Albans, West Virginia. I'm 85 years old. I still work every day if I can. Sometimes I don't make it all day.
Having always been artistically inclined, James started out as a hand sign painter, but switched to neon as demand increased for the style, teaching himself the trade after observing other neon sign makers. While neon signs are now ubiquitous, most people don't really know what a neon sign is actually made of, or that they're almost all made by hand.
It's a piece of glass that's bent the way you want to bend, and there's an electrode on each end of it, and filled with gas, and when it's hooked up to a transformer, it'll light up.
James's workshop looks like some mad scientist's den. 3 open flame torches burn at about 800 degrees, providing heat for James to bend the glass into shapes and letters. A manifold with valves and gauges sits in the corner. James uses this to create a vacuum in the glass tubes and pump them with neon or argon gas. Neon burns a bright orange red, and argon burns blue. An electric transformer pulsing with voltage sits next to the manifold, and various lengths of different colored glass tubes hang on the wall and are strewn about workshop tables. Once all the letters are formed, he welds the letters together in the crossfires to connect them into one piece.
Next step would be, it'd be called a unit then. I would take it over and put it on the manifold, hook it up to the manifold and pump it into it with the vacuum. When it's in a vacuum, it should light up, and then after it lights up, it'll burn the impurities out of it. And after it cools, that means it's sterile and it's ready to gas after it cools off, yes.
After bombarding the unit with gas, James hooks it up to the transformer. If there are any impurities remaining in the unit, it won't light up. The color of the sign depends on the combination of the gas and the glass.
I could usually make them in a couple hours, making them and putting them together and gas them and blacking them out.
James makes the whole process look easy, but he's constantly making micro adjustments, heating the glass just enough so it will bend without breaking, making sure the letters are formed with the exact angles, and being careful not to overfill the unit with gas, all while trying to avoid injuring himself.
Well, I'd always plan on getting burned or getting cut, one or the other, both, either one. So usually burning is the worst, yeah.
James is one of the few active neon sign makers in the Kanawha Valley. If you have a favorite sign in the area, you can probably bet he's made it.
Here's the one at the airport for Tudor's and Gino's. Susie's Hamburger here in South Charleston. He's a hunting buddy of mine. In the Auburn Theater, Sam's Hot Dogs. I've done several of them.
Like the old blues trope of the musician who performs in juke joints on Saturday night and church on Sunday morning, James has made signs for both bars and churches alike.
My new home has a flashy neon sign.
After all, neon is that beacon in the dead of night indicating life and spirit, whether liquid or holy.
Yeah, I've done several churches, yes, ma'am. A lot of them, yes. I have done several strip clubs. I done one with a woman on it. We put up at Parkersburg. It had a neon lady on it, and I was going to paint a picture of a naked lady over here on the church after he got his church built. And my wife said she wanted to pose for me. I said, "Well, it'd be all right."
James didn't end up making a sign of his wife, but he did make one for her, wired into the kitchen lights.
It's says Barb's Kitchen on it, and it's made out of pink neon, which is blue pumped with neon, yeah. It's in the, up above the kitchen sink, yes. Mm-hmm.
Through sign making, James has found a community of friends.
I try to make friends wherever if I do something for somebody. I have made some friends over the years. I don't know, a lot of people I work for, I think they are my friends. They seems to be anyhow.
After over 50 years in the industry, James has noticed changes, but is hopeful about a neon revival.
Mostly everything's going to vinyl, vinyl lettering, and the neon is going to LEDs. So I believe eventually neon will come back. I think it will come back. I think it has in different places. I think they use a lot of it in different parts of the country. Of course, Las Vegas is big on neon. They always have been.
Regardless, he knows his work will live on. If made well, neon signs can last for nearly 100 years.
I've had them in here, before they were 75 years old and older than that, still burning. Everybody comes in, I say, if you don't like neon sign, there's something wrong with you. And they'll say, yeah, that's right, yeah. Everybody likes neon.
Despite the decline in demand, James is unequivocal about the universal allure of neon, no matter if you're a churchgoer, a barfly, family, or friend.
Standing in the spotlight, chasing that neon rainbow, I'm living that honky-tonk dream.
For the West Virginia Folklife Program in Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Hilliard at Day Sign Company in St. Albans, West Virginia.
Emily is West Virginia's folklorist. She worked with videographer Chuck Klein to produce a video of that story. Check it out. You can watch James Day make a neon sign by hand on wvpublic.org. Earlier in our episode, we heard a story about a man who's helping preserve his family's historic mill. A family connection can be what helps some Appalachians find value in a place they call home. Next, we'll travel to Lincoln County, North Carolina, to meet an artist who's putting his own spin on a family legacy. Historically, the Catawba River Valley is pottery country. The Reinhardt family worked here for generations, making utilitarian pots for farmers. Now Michael Gates is building on his ancestors' work. Joe O'Connell introduces us.
Michael has always been creative, but it took him a while to find his calling as an artist. He spent time in Australia, lived in California, and then, about 5 years ago, inspiration struck, much closer to home. I'm in North Carolina's Catawba River Valley with Michael and his dad, Jim. We're making our way through the overgrowth beside an old farmhouse. It's been in their family for generations. In the 19th century, this whole region was a hotbed of pottery production. Dozens of artisans, many of them German, made ceramic jugs, the kind that people needed to store food, water, and essentials. Michael's ancestors were among those artisans, and as late as the 1950s, members of his family were still making pots in the old utilitarian style.
This was the firebox right here.
The spot where we are now is where Michael's great-grandfather built his kiln, what they call a groundhog kiln, dug into the earth and enclosed by an arched brick roof.
I'll show him the arch.
And you can come down a little bit and you can see the arch in here. And as you can see, it's pretty much glazed over and all still intact. There might be one or two bricks that have fallen out. It's in really good shape considering its age.
For Michael, this has always been a family monument. But now it's also a source of artistic vision. In recent years, he's been making regular visits to the Catawba Valley, and they've led him to completely rethink his own art.
In my education and just early on, I enjoyed surrealism and kind of went through phases and never really found a focus until I started looking closely at my own history and the region.
That's when something clicked. When he got a bit of distance, Michael saw that the creative foundation he was looking for was already in place, back where he'd started.
I guess you realize how unique it is, and you know, all the things that you grow up seeing that you just take for granted and that kind of thing.
The story of Catawba Valley pottery has become the jumping-off point for Michael's own pottery. Of course, his pots aren't quite the same utilitarian objects his ancestors made. They're art. and sometimes he even pushes the limits of what counts as pottery, such as the time he made a more modern version of the face jug, one of the valley's most iconic forms.
I bought some liquid photo emulsion I could paint on the pots I was making, and I started developing pictures onto the pots. I was taking pictures of my friends' faces and putting them on jugs and making face jugs and just having fun with it.
Years later, Michael still loves turning a historical style on its ear. In 2017, he entered a juried exhibit at the North Carolina Pottery Center called The Last Drop, Intoxicating Pottery, Past and Present. For source material, Michael looked back all the way to a 17th century English piece, a slipware vessel in the form of an owl. If drinking out of an owl sounds wild, drinking out of Michael's reinterpretation would surely be even wilder. The owl's face has what looks like a scornful, disapproving expression. Its ceramic body is densely adorned with underglazed decorations of hop vines and written phrases lifted from the American Prohibition movement. It's a clever and masterfully made piece. Not surprisingly, it sold immediately. From Michael's dad's perspective, Michael's stylistic experiments are all a welcome addition to the family story.
Michael, he does some things that just blew my mind. He'll make face jugs and he'll put decorations on them. It looks like henna tattoos. Sells them in Asheville. It would have blown my grandfather's mind. I wished he could have lived to have seen some of Michael's work.
Enoch Reinhardt, Jim's grandfather, left pottery behind before collectors really began to crave work from the Catawba Valley in the 1970s and 80s. And Jim appreciates that Michael is making the leap into art pottery that his grandfather never could.
By Michael being able to work in the pottery field, it throws a little light back on my grandfather.
Michael wants his pottery to be a viable business, but he's still got a ways to go. One thing he lacks is a sizable wood-fired kiln of his own, so he can boost his production. That's part of why Michael and Jim are turning their attention to their family's old kiln. It's going to take a lot of work and some help from neighbors to rebuild it. But if things go well, they'll be able to fire it later this summer. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Joe O'Connell in Henry, North Carolina.
In North Carolina and East Tennessee, several families have passed down the art of singing traditional Appalachian ballads. You know, those stories told in a song. There are love ballads, murder ballads, and often the two go hand in hand. A new album titled Big Bend Killing, The Appalachian Ballad Tradition, celebrates the rich tradition of songs that tell stories, one that influenced many genres of music, including country, bluegrass, and rock. The collection has been nominated for a Grammy Award. From member station WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Wayne Winkler has this report.
Oh, mother, come riddle my sport. Come riddle it all in one. Must I marry Fair Ellender? Or bring the brown girl home.
Sheila Kay Adams is one of the most recognized and renowned living ballad singers. She is one of the artists featured on a new CD box set entitled Big Bend Killing, The Appalachian Ballad Tradition. The song you sing on this collection is Lord Thomas and Fair Ellender, and it's kind of like a movie or a soap opera you might see on television.
Well, I'm glad you said that because it is kind of like a soap opera. And the brown girl was a daughter of the Normans, who were the conquerors. And as you know, the conquerors are the ones that write history.
Lord Thomas decides to marry the brown girl, but invites Fair Ellender to attend the wedding. Ellender's mother advised Ellender not to go.
And she says, nope, I'm going if it's the last thing I do. And turns out it was. The brown girl had a little penknife. It was both keen and sharp. Betwixt the long rib and the short, she pierced Fair Ellender's heart. She pierced Fair Ellender's heart.
Ballads were the news of the day. People would tell stories about things that had happened wherever they lived.
Ted Olson is a professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University and producer of Big Bend Killing. The 2-CD set is the fourth in a series of acclaimed albums produced by Olson for the Great Smoky Mountains Association.
A handful of the ballads here are from the Smokies, but others are from elsewhere, including some British ballads that we included to tell the backstory to Appalachian balladry. You know, Appalachian balladry owing so much to British balladry. So we kind of start the project with both British and Appalachian musicians interpreting British ballads. That encompasses CD1, and CD2 includes a lot of ballads which are what we call New World ballads. These are the ballads that were created entirely in the New World, and in this case, in Appalachia.
'Twas in the merry month of May, when green buds all were swelling, sweet William on his deathbed lay, for love of Barbara Allen.
That's Roseanne Cash performing Barbara Allen, one of the best-known ballads in this collection.
400 years ago, Samuel Pepys documented having heard what he called a little Scotch song. And that is the shell that ultimately became Barbara Allen. It deals with the ramifications of love unrealized. And so ultimately it became very prolific around the British Isles, and eventually as emigrants came to the United States, they brought with them this ballad. And it is the ballad that Tom Burton documented as being the most widely dispersed of all the ballads that are British in origin in Appalachia.
I just grew up hearing all this old-time music and ballad singing, and it's very dear to my heart because of the place that I come from.
Donna Ray Norton is an eighth-generation ballad singer who, like her cousin Sheila Kay Adams, grew up in the Sodom Laurel community of Western North Carolina.
When you're in Sodom, you're in a whole nother time and place. The reason, I guess, that we kept singing the old songs and stuff, and the reason that they're so pure, is because it was a lot of the same people in that area. It just kind of consisted of several different families: the Wallens, Rays, Nortons, Chandlers, Adamses, that sort of thing. So we all just were like a big community, and those songs just stayed in our family because we didn't really have television. We barely had those little turn-dial radios when I was a little girl.
Oh, holiday, oh, holy day, the first day of the year. Little Matthew Groves to church did go, some holy words to hear. Hear some holy words to hear. The first come down is dressed in red, the next come down in green. The next come down is Lord Dan'l's wife, as fine as any queen, queen, fine as any queen.
Little Matthew Groves is one of my favorite ballads, but it is a really good ballad. It's just got all the things that you want to hear about in an old love song. It's got a lot of unrequited love and murder and all that sort of stuff.
All the things that make up a
all
classic ballad.
All the things that make up a good soap opera.
Matthew Groves was a commoner who got involved with a more aristocratic woman.
Yep, she was married to Lord Dan'l, as that we called him in the song. She was a queen, and little Matthew Groves was just a commoner. But she fancied him, I suppose, and he saw her one night at a party, and she stepped up to him and kind of asked him to come spend the night with her. And at first he told her no, because he knew who she was. And she promised him pleasure beyond compare, and he just couldn't say no, and that was the wrong thing for him to do.
Get up, Lord Dan'l cried, and go put on your clothes. In England it shall never be said that I killed a naked man, man, that I killed a naked man. I won't get up, I can't get up, for fear 'twill cost my life.
For you have got two bitter swords, and I ain't got a knife, knife, and I ain't got a knife.
While many of the ballads in the Big Ben Killing collection originated in the British Isles and were brought to America, others originated here and told of events in specific locations and were sung only in those locations.
One of the ballads on the set that has never been recorded before is by Bobby McMillan, the great North Carolina ballad singer, Old Joe Dawson. And it's about an argument that happened over a moonshine still. It's
shot him in his neck and he fell on his side. Oh, Lordy, Lord. Shot him in his neck and he fell on his side. That was the death Joe Dawson died. Oh, Lordy me.
Another ballad that originated entirely on the Appalachian frontier is performed by Trevor McKenzie, the Battle Song of the Great Kanawha, also known as the Battle of Point Pleasant.
The Battle of Point Pleasant happened in 1774 in October, and it was a battle between an alliance of the Shawnee and the Wyandot tribes, and the Delawares, and a group of Virginians who were a militia company. And this ballad was recorded in a family Bible.
In 1774, in the month of October, we know an army of Indians, 2,000 or more, were camped on the Ohio. The Shawnee and the Wyandot, Delawares and tribes of Mingo, invaded our lands and citizens slew on the south of the Ohio.
The 32 ballads featured on Big Ben Killing are accompanied by a 74-page booklet featuring an essay, track-by-track notes, and photographs. This booklet was nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Album Notes. The collection has received nominations for Best Liner Notes and Best Design from the International Bluegrass Music Association. Those awards will be announced at the end of September. All proceeds from the sale of this album will support the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wayne Winkler.
The sons of mountains renowned of old all volunteered freely to go and conquer the army our country to save or fall by the Ohio. So they marched through the untrodden wilds of the west and mountains and rivers also, and they pitched at the point their bodies to rest on the banks of the Ohio.
Up next, we'll hear why putting down your phone and getting outdoors and bringing your kids with you may be one of the best things for your body, mind, and your mental health. And we'll go explore Blackwater Falls at night for stargazing. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Oh, holiday, oh, holy day, the first day of the year. Little Matthew Groves to church did go, some holy words to hear, hear some holy words to hear. The first come down is dressed in red, the next come down in green. The next come down is Lord Dan'l's wife, as fine as any queen, queen, fine as any queen.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
We're growing our Inside Appalachia team. We're hiring a new part-time folklife reporter. We've posted a link on our website where you can apply, wvpublic.org, and be on the lookout for even more opportunities to join our team. Oh, and by the way, Halloween is up ahead, and we're working on an episode about ghost stories in Appalachia. Do you have a favorite scary story or legend from your community that you'd like to share with us? We're teaming up with the West Virginia Folklife Program for this episode, so call their hotline and tell us about your ghost story. Leave a message at 1-844-618-3747. Again, that's 1-844-618-3747. 1-800-273-4047. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. About 10 years ago, the National Park Service noticed that fewer kids and families were using the parks, and they wanted to change that. So in 2009, they partnered with the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation to launch an initiative to help families unplug, get outside, and connect with their local natural resources. Kara Lofton reports that the initiative called Kids in the Park soon expanded to include pediatricians who are trying to combat childhood obesity, diabetes, and excess screen time by writing scripts for kids to go outside. Think of it as a new way of looking at your neighborhood green space or backyard.
6-year-old Hannah sits at her dining room table munching on an apple as she describes making fairy dust from leaves and seeing a turtle while at a Kids in the Park event earlier this year.
My favorite things to do are probably run around and play with nature and make stuff with nature.
Her mom, pediatrician Erin Reagan, sits beside her listening. Reagan is involved with the National Park RX movement. The idea is to write prescriptions for kids to get unplugged, go outside, take a walk, play with dirt, get moving. It's something she says she's conscientious about with her patients as well as her own children.
If I have a kid who is overweight, a kid who is spending a lot of time in front of the TV, we ask about screen time at every checkup. I'll make the offer. And then we just have a placard up in our waiting room. And so anybody who's interested, who notices that and wants to participate, can ask about it, and we're happy to have them participate as well.
Reagan says from her perspective as a pediatrician, kids aren't moving nearly enough, and they're spending far too much time in front of screens. As a result, they're restless and have a harder time managing their emotions.
Everything sets them off. I don't think like they feel like they're in control almost. They don't know what to do with themselves.
The science, she says, shows that kids who move more focus better and maybe even learn better. At Okanichi Mountain State Natural Area in Hillsboro, North Carolina, Kids in the Park director Jason Euros is walking through one of the Kids in the Park track trails. He stops at a colorful sign where two mascots, a dog, track, and a dragonfly, are depicted in bright colors explaining the different activities kids can do.
It attracts kids to want to come over here and look at this sign. And then you've got the directions of the map telling you how long this hike is, and these are the trails that are in this park, and while you're hiking the trails, use these different brochures on your hike in order to, you know, learn about the pond life or the trees or, you know, go on a hide-and-seek scavenger hunt.
As kids complete a hiker brochure, they can register online for little gifts such as stickers or a bandana. Additionally, if a child has participated in the park prescriptions program, when they register the activity or hike, their pediatrician gets a message, and that information is added to his or her medical file. The hope, he says, is that if they can get kids excited about getting outdoors early in life, it will become a life habit.
Try to make our trails 1 to 2 miles in length so that they're not overly strenuous and kids have a good time and they see different things and then want to do it again.
It begins to rain, and we duck under some trees to meet up with Sean Higgins, the education manager for North Carolina State Parks.
Kids have been throwing rocks in streams and running through the forest for tens of thousands of years. And kids more and more are indoors. They're indoors more than, you know, any previous generation. They're spending time on video games and on screens.
Higgins says he thinks a lot about what kids get from video games, and he thinks it's a feeling of control, getting to make decisions without an adult steering them.
I think kids can get those same things outdoors. I think things like the Kids in Parks track trails give kids the opportunity to make decisions. You know, which topics do I want to explore on the trail? It gives kids the opportunity to achieve things. They can earn some really cool prizes for doing this.
And it seems to be working. Kids in the Park director, Urez, says 54% who participate are first-time visitors to a park, and 11% of kids were first-time hikers. Pediatrician Reagan has only been writing scripts for about 6 months and says for her, it's too soon to see if the program is having an impact on obesity, diabetes, and screen time. But anything that encourages kids to get outside and get excited about it is a win. She says she realizes getting outside can be really tough for working families, but making an effort makes a difference.
Right. My husband and I both work And so we really do our best to spend a lot of time on the weekends doing things, getting out of the house, not being inside and just plopping in front of the TV yet again.
Although there are Kids in the Parks locations all up and down the Blue Ridge, only one park in West Virginia currently participates, Harper's Ferry National Park in the Eastern Panhandle. URS says he'd love to have some more West Virginia parks on board. All it takes is for the park to reach out and say, hey, we'd like to participate. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
When people talk about getting outdoors in Appalachia, some things that may come to mind is ATV riding, whitewater rafting, hunting, or fishing. I know in my family, ATV riding was one of the most common ways we got out into nature. If you're searching for the best fly fishing spots to catch wild trout in the U.S., Central Pennsylvania still makes top 10 lists. That's despite historical pollution and runoff from agriculture and development. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant heads to the region to find out how people there are working to keep these premier streams clean.
It's just before sunset, and 27-year-old Matt Kowalczyk is standing in the river near the bank of Penn's Creek in central Pennsylvania, not far from State College. He's a fly fishing guide and chooses a lure meant to catch wild trout.
We're going to see if we can get one to eat a stonefly. It's hard to pass up a big meal.
Kowalczyk attaches the fly to his line and walks deeper into the center of the fast-moving creek. He casts upstream. His line doesn't dance through the air like in a river runs through it, but his lure lands lightly on the water and floats down a ways. No bites, so he pulls it out and casts upstream again.
And you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. The next thing you know, boom, a bar of gold just rolls up and annihilates your fly. Yeah, it's pretty intense. It gets the adrenaline pumping.
Kowalczyk considered moving to Montana or Colorado after college, but he loves it here.
In the middle of Pennsylvania, mountains all around you, watching the bald eagles chase the osprey for the trout.
In high summer, the water is still cool, maybe 60 degrees, and remains that temperature because it's fed by cold springs and mountain creeks. Unlike some streams, the state doesn't stock Penn's Creek with trout.
It doesn't need it. This stream is Class A wild trout water, meaning that it has a naturally sustaining population of fish that does not need us to do anything about. If you come here in October and November, you can walk the stream and find the fish actively spawning. And that is cool to see.
One reason the trout do well here, abundant food. When I visited, Kowalczyk was just finishing up with the angling frenzy around the hatch of green drake and especially large mayfly.
And that's a huge draw. That is the big hatch here. That's the reason everyone comes to fish, the green drake. It's actually pretty insane.
Even closer to State College in nearby Spring Creek, a spill of cyanide at Penn State in the 1950s wiped out the green drake population. The mayflies have never recovered there. There's usually not one big pollution source anymore. Today, it's more like death by a thousand cuts. Urbanization and growth in State College, like rooftops, roads, and parking lots, cause runoff and pollution in Spring Creek. In the more rural Penn's Creek watershed, it's the farms. One-third of the land here is in agriculture, corn, soy, and dairy.
This was a cow pasture. And that was a cow pasture.
David Martinick is working with the Penns Valley Conservation Association, a local nonprofit, to restore the stream bed at his longtime family farm. He points to the high bank on the far side of the creek, where a backhoe is moving hemlock logs brought in for a restoration project.
And we took the cattle off. The non-native invasive species just grew up and just choked everything out.
The Conservation Association's Lyle Sherwin, who leads many area landowners on projects like this, says the bare soil of the cow pastures left these stream banks without tree roots for structure.
They're falling into the stream. Massive erosion.
You can see silt from the eroding bank filling up the shallow stream here. Sherwin says this limestone bed is spawning ground for trout, and the sediment literally smothers their eggs. That's why they're building what's basically a reinforced wall of logs along the stream.
It simulates an eroded bank that has structure and function to it, but it's a built bank. It's a stable bank.
Sherwin has worked on 14 improvement projects like this in recent years and says the more they do, the more landowners want to try it.
it's sort of keeping up with the Joneses. Oh, wait a minute, they did that stream project and it worked for them and they seem happy with it.
Many of these projects get funding through a USDA program that's proposed to be cut in the House version of the 2018 Farm Bill. Sherwin hopes funding doesn't dry up because the more stream restoration, the better for the wild brown trout in Penn's Creek and for the anglers who pour in to catch them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. If you've been fishing this summer, or if you've been out hiking in the woods, did you notice any difference in how you felt? Some researchers have noticed that when a person visits a natural area, even just for a few minutes, there are calming, rejuvenating, and restorative benefits. Japan developed a concept called Shinrin-yoku, also known as forest bathing or forest therapy, in the 1980s, and it's becoming more popular in the U.S. And yet, even in rural and forested areas like Appalachia, accessing natural areas can be difficult. Carol Often spoke with two WVU professors about the benefits of getting into nature and why forest bathing could make the sights and sounds at your local park take on a whole new meaning.
White Park is an oasis in an otherwise bustling Morgantown with trails through wooded areas and a reservoir. West Virginia professor Sam Zuzzi spoke about forest bathing during a recent walk through the park.
The way they use that concept in Japan is they encounter to a very stressful modern working society where people are overworked. They have one of the highest depression and suicide rates in the civilized world. And so they develop these forest bathing centers that are outside of the city.
Participants weren't necessarily doing intense physical activity, but rather walking or sitting and meditating without technology and with awareness.
Pay attention to sounds, pay attention to the senses, changes, the smells. And then they were measuring what was happening when they put them back in the urban environment. So how long did the tranquility hang up, how long did the stress relief last? And so they were seeing effects that were lasting weeks and months in changing their cardiovascular profile.
Yep, you heard that right. Not only did being in nature improve participant stress levels, but according to a 2017 study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health, pulse rate and blood pressure dropped significantly after subjects participated in a short forest bathing program. But the thing is, you don't need to go to a specific center to experience these benefits.
Forest bathing, in its essence, is really being mindful of your environment and exposing yourself to that natural world, but it could really be anywhere.
Access to green spaces is usually an urban conversation, but Zizzi argues it's one we need to have in West Virginia as well.
The easiest choice needs to be the best choice for physical and mental health. And right now, that's not necessarily the case in our environment. That's not necessarily only West Virginia either. But the system does make the easy choice sometimes quite difficult.
Meaning that even though people who live in rural areas are by default closer to trees, they also may not have easy access to walkable trails, parks, and greenways. If it's not easy to go outside and walk around, people aren't going to do it. Professor Christian Abelzado works with Zizzi and joined us at White Park. Abelzado focuses on health policy and says there are active things the state legislature could do to change that.
Honestly, we could dedicate 10% of our transportation budget to non-motorized projects. Done.
Meaning adding walking paths around ball fields so parents can move while their kids are playing sports, connecting existing parks to sidewalks, and expanding roads to include bike lanes so people don't need to get in a car at all.
And if you think of rural America, industrial America was built on two things, rail and water, right? So we have tremendous, now that those things are going away, we have the remaining rail beds to convert to rail trails, and we have rivers that if we clean up, we could be out paddling, and we provide access. That can be expensive, but if we can provide access to it, I mean, that would be amazing.
Zizzi chimes in again.
And those are the type of the solutions that we have to get, and they're happening in areas in West Virginia, but they're one-offs. They're in that county, but not in the other 54. So they're starting to happen. But it needs to be, you know, obviously for larger changes, for us to get into the middle even, we would need progressive, amazing policies.
In the meantime, they say, get outside any way you can and leave your phone at home. You might just find that a quick nature bath is just the thing you need. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
More than a third of American adults don't get enough sleep, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the problem is even worse in West Virginia. As Kara Lofton reports, restarting sleep patterns may begin with getting outside at night. For some, it's a whole new way to explore this popular West Virginia tourist destination.
At Blackwater State Park, Pauletta Cousins is leading a night hike.
So that is actually a natural resource up there above us, and it's disappearing at the speed of light. So if you look at the United States, or even the world from outer space, well, in the United States, you'll see that the whole eastern United States is all brightly lit up. You can see it from space. There's one little small dark spot on the east. Where's that?
West Virginia is one of the darkest spots on the eastern seaboard, a fact that could be good news for our health.
When it's dark, we're naturally supposed to be sleeping. And light is actually messing up a chemical that we have in our body to make us be healthy individuals.
Exposure to light suppresses the secretion of melatonin, a hormone that influences circadian rhythms. And there's some early evidence that lower melatonin levels might explain the association with cancer. Despite being one of the darkest spots on the East Coast, West Virginia ties with New York, with almost 40% of residents reporting less than 7 hours of sleep a night. Not getting enough sleep is associated with metabolic problems, issues with insulin resistance, and weight gain, according to the National Institutes of Health. Interestingly, nationwide, sleep patterns look similar to maps of obesity and diabetes prevalence. So, if your circadian rhythms are messed up, how do you reset them?
We did a study, actually a series of three studies, where we used camping essentially as a tool to escape the light exposure that you get in modern cities.
That's Chris Deppner, a postdoctoral fellow in the sleep lab of the University of Colorado Boulder. He was part of a study to see if we escaped all electrical light, what would that do to our bodies and our biological clocks?
Over a week, our biological clocks basically tune themselves to the timing of sunrise and sunset. So that means during the normal biological or environmental night, that's when our bodies were trying to sleep, and during the day, that's when we were supposed to be awake.
They then tested the hypothesis over just a weekend of camping.
And we saw that about 70% of that effect happened over just the weekend. So that means when you think about that, like on Monday morning, then when you wake up, your body's going to be more in tune with the environmental cycle versus perhaps if you're living in the electrical lighting environment, where you could be more in tune with the electrical environment.
While light of any kind can suppress the secretion of melatonin, blue light at night, such as the kind found on phones, computers, and TVs, does so more powerfully. A Harvard study found that when people were exposed to blue versus green light, blue light suppresses melatonin for about twice as long as the green light and shifted circadian rhythms by twice as much. What isn't clear from the research is whether spending more time outside does the trick, or if simply dimming the lights in your home and turning off the TV, cell phone, and other electronic devices a couple hours before bed would suffice. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Was in the merry month of May, when green...
And don't forget to check out the videos and photos from the stories in today's episode. You can find it at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. And send us your favorite ghost stories. We're looking forward to hunting down some great haunted tales for our Halloween episode. Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. When you try to describe the unique characteristics of this region and Appalachian people, you might struggle to explain this intangible flavor that's just a part of us. Some things you often hear described can be found in other places too, like mountains or loyalty, memories of home, and yes, you'll even find an epidemic of people struggling with opioid addiction, poverty, and hunger. But if you look hard enough, you'll find beauty in pain, and lots of hidden gems along the way. Sometimes it takes a different perspective to make us see past our struggles and hardships to find the hidden gems in this region. I never imagined going on vacation in West Virginia until I got older. When I heard visitors talk about how much fun they had here, I felt an obligation to explore as much as I could. I've been checking out more places and finding even more beauty in this place and our people. Have you recently found a place in Appalachia that brought back childhood memories of just pure joy? What kind of skills have been passed down in your family? What kind of places do you treasure in Appalachia? While we can't go to everyone's grandma's house, we'd love to hear about your hidden gem in Appalachia. Send us a tweet to @InAppalachia or send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, and the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh. Music in today's show was provided by Roseanne Cash, who's featured on the new Grammy-nominated album called Big Bend Killing, the Appalachian Ballad Tradition. Music was also provided by Dinosaur Burps, Ben Townsend, Marisa Anderson, The Howie Tapes, and Earthskins. Roxy Todd is our producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Molly Bourne edited our show this week. She's also our web editor. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can always reach out to us on Twitter @InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org or address your letters to Inside Appalachia at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. If you'd like to listen to any part of this episode again, don't forget you can subscribe or download all of our stories on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.